the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. David Pollack is my guest. He is a comedy writer who has written for The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and MASH, and other shows we love. He has a new book out, and it is a wonderful book, entitled Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. It's a biography of Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding, as well as Harlow P. Whitcomb, Arthur Sturdley, the McBeebe twins, Barry Campbell, and Wally Ballou. David Pollack, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Pleasure.
I want to talk all about your book and about Bob and Ray, but you're part of a comedy team yourself.
That's right. I've worked with a partner, Elias Davis, for almost 40 years, writing various TV shows.
Pretty much exclusively comedy.
Almost exclusively comedy, yeah, not even pretty much. It's not that unusual in comedy to have teams, unlike dramatic shows where there is more of a single vision of one person. Often in comedy shows, not always, but quite frequently there are teams where you sort of sit in a room and bat things back and forth and in the process arrive at a final script.
And do you crack each other up as you're doing it?
There is a lot of laughing, yes.
It's not all serious business, this writing thing.
No, it's sort of a combination. A lot of the laughs do end up in the script, hopefully. And then when it's done, nobody can identify who contributed what often, because it's sort of arrived at like ping pong going back and forth.
Does one of you sit at the typewriter or computer keyboard and type, and the other one paces back and forth?
You know, that's how we did it much of the time. My partner was that one who sat at the keyboard, and I don't know how much pacing I did, but I certainly stretched out on a couch sometimes.
I know you worked on a lot of things, including the last episode of MASH was has a credit of yours, yeah?
That's right, yeah.
And that was a fabulous show. I guess that's one episode you could say not exactly a comedy, because although MASH was a comedy, that was a slightly more serious episode.
That's true. It was more dramatic, and in effect, a lot of people were disappointed that there wasn't a little more comedy in that final episode.
Oh, well, everybody loved it. We all cried our eyes out, and it was like a 2-hour plus episode, if I recall.
It was 2.5 hours, yeah. Yeah, and I remember that that night they had a little party planned for all the staff, and I remember driving to it. It was in a Moroccan restaurant here in L.A. that Alan Alda liked, and it was strange that there was no cars on the street. I mean, the streets were empty, people watching that show.
Hmm. Well, it was a great show. How did you get started in television?
Well, not really equipped to do anything else. I had no other real marketable skills. My father had been a writer, and so I was sort of exposed to it early on, although I didn't necessarily show any interest in wanting to be a TV writer during my, through high school and college, but ultimately just sort of gravitated to it. Started writing for various disc jockeys and then ended up as a page at CBS, and that's where I met Elias Davis.
Hmm. And what were some of the first things you were successful at getting on screen?
Well, the first network show was the Joey Bishop Late Night Show.
Oh, that was on ABC at 11:30?
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And that was back in 1967. And then we went from there, I think, briefly to the Pat Boone Show, and then 2 years with Steve Allen. And then
Pat Boone, he had like an afternoon show, wasn't it?
It was an hour and a half syndicated show. It was on at various times in different cities, yeah. But I'm sure it was on in the afternoon in large hunks of the country.
I remember that show well. I remember the Joey Bishop Show well also. Regis Philbin was Joey's announcer on the show.
That's right. That's right.
What comedians, I'm assuming Bob and Ray, but who else influenced you when you were forming your comedic tastes?
Well, you know, it sort of started with being a kid and just being in the backseat of the car, and my father always had the radio on, and it even started before television, so, you know, I was hearing all those shows, not necessarily focusing on them, but I'm sure a lot of it went over my head. But, you know, Jack Benny and Bob Hope and Amos and Andy and all those shows. And so it was always sort of there. It was always sort of a buzz going on. And it sort of demystified the whole area of entertainment for me. But you're right, I was a huge fan of Bob and Ray's. And I love when I discovered Steve Allen on The Tonight Show. I mean, I thought he was hilarious. And
you wrote for Steve Allen also, did you not?
Yeah, I did.
Now you've written this marvelous book. We're talking with David Pollack, and he's a comedy writer, and his new book is called Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. I love Bob and Ray. I've always loved them. And I can't remember, you know, not knowing who they were. I had a record when I was a little kid, Bob and Ray on a Platter. I had that album.
Sure.
And I particularly loved this bit where they were cowboys who couldn't figure out how to get off their horses.
Yeah, right.
But I think Bob and Ray, they're like it's kind of hard to explain them to young people today who are unfamiliar with them. They're kind of an enigma.
Well, yeah, they're different. They were different from other radio and TV performers because the others, the mainstream comedians, were people who sort of played to the third balcony. You know, they played to an audience. Whereas Bob and Ray were, well, if you were to distill them down to their purest essence, they were two guys entertaining themselves and each other, but the audience was in on it. The real lure was the byplay and their relationship and a kind of infectious camaraderie. You wanted to, as I said in the book, you wanted to learn their secret handshake. As Bob's son, Chris Elliott, did sort of describe it, they were like two uncles who, when they got together, always made you laugh.
And of course, Chris Elliott himself is a kind of an offbeat comic, too.
Right, right.
Well, I was really fascinated in your book because, naturally, I assumed that Bob and Ray must have been best friends and spent, you know, every waking minute together because they had such a great rhythm and rapport. I mean, they seemed to know each other so well, but that really wasn't the case.
Well, they did know each other real well on the air. I mean, that's true. But yeah, it was I guess you'd call it a professional relationship. But they never had any major disruptions or any major fallings out either. And in fact, we're together longer than most teams, longer than Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, Burns and Allen. They were together about 44 years.
Well, I guess they got together when they were young and they stayed together.
Yeah. They were very different guys. As I point out in the book, one similarity that they had with other great teams was their dissimilarity with each other. And you sort of have to have that with comedy. You sort of have to have, you know, that sort of tension that creates the comedy. And they were two very different guys, right? Ray was sort of a little more outspoken and commanding. Bob was quiet, reserved, deferential. Bob was kind of a New England Yankee, a terrific artist, painted beautiful New England watercolors and portraits of all of his kids and grandchildren. He was a big antique collector, and still is. He built an entire extension on his summer home, basically all by himself. Ray was very into. They were both big family guys, and you know, Ray was at all of his kids' little league games, and the Boston Red Sox were like a mania with him. In fact, he used to, I tell the story in the book that he was so, he'd get so caught up with the Boston Red Sox during, particularly during seasons when they'd be fighting for the pennant late in the year and living on Long Island where he did. He had difficulty picking up their games on the radio, so he would actually go out at night to, into his car and sit in the driveway to pull in the Red Sox Hartford affiliates to hear their games.
Well, their team, like you say, unlike the comedy teams that we think of Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Martin and Lewis, neither of them were the straight man.
Well, that you could say that, or you could say both were straight both men, and both were the funny guys. I mean, they sort of traded off. Both could do accents. Both could do voices. Both could be straight. If you went through all of their routines, it would sort of come out pretty much even. Ray's characters tended to be more outspoken and hyperbolic. You think of characters that he played like Artie Skermerhorn or Captain Wolf Larson. You may remember the sportscaster Steve Bosco. Ray played a lot of giddy women characters whenever they would be called for, including, you know, their longtime character, Mary Magoon. Ray was Charles the Poet and Dean Archer Armstead. Usually when a guest with a ridiculous occupation would be interviewed, Ray would usually do that part, and then Bob's deadpan, level-headed interrogation then sort of pushed against the premise, like a sort of like a ground wire, and sort of ratified the absurdity and further advanced it.
As a public service paid for by the National Foundation to Improve Things, we invite you now to spend another educational session with the idol of the nation's youngsters, Mr. Science. And as we look in on the laboratory today, we see that little Jimmy Schwab is just arriving to watch Mr. Science perform his latest fascinating experiment.
Well, hello there, Jimmy. You're right on time to watch me perform my latest fascinating experiment.
Gosh, all hemlock, Mr. Science. What fascinating experiment are you going to perform today?
Well, I'm sure you'll remember from last time we were discussing Archimedes' principle, and I promised to demonstrate it for you.
Holy cow, Mr. Science. I don't remember anything about that at all.
Well, that's all right, Jimmy.
The doctors have told my parents that I'll probably never be able to remember anything for as long as a week.
Well, Archimedes' principle only takes a moment to review. It states that a body immersed in water will only sink until it has displaced the amount of liquid that's equal to its own mass and density. Now do you understand, Jimmy?
Gee, willikers, I don't think so. And even if I do, I can't remember it for a week.
Well, I'm sure after you've observed today's experiment, it'll be fixed more firmly in your mind. Now, to prove Archimedes' principle, we first must fill this bucket with liquid.
Criminally, Mr. Science, that liquid looks exactly like the stuff we get in our bathtub at home when we turn on the faucet.
Well, that's just could be, Jimmy, because the bucket now contains ordinary household water.
Household water? Great day in the morning. Mm. Wait till I tell the kids at school I've seen some of that.
Now, let's try to keep yourself under control, son. I know this is a big thrill for you, but the best part is still to come. Now, I'm going to toss this rock into the bucket of water, and you watch carefully what happens.
Holy Moses, Mr. Science. It went clear to the bottom underneath all the liquid.
Exactly. And do you know why?
Golly, no. I never expected that to happen.
Well, just remember what we said about Archimedes' principle. You see, the rock was heavier than the water, and that's why it sank in an effort to displace its own mass and density.
Great suffering catfish. It's like the wonders of the universe were unfolding before my very eyes.
Well, that's very well put, Jimmy. Now, to complete our experiment, I'll place this wooden toothpick in the same bucket of water.
Boy, oh boy, look at that. It's not sinking in an effort to displace its own mass and density. So Archimedes was wrong, huh?
No, not at all, Jimmy. You see, wood is lighter than water.
Even a whole tree full of it?
Yes, in proportion to its size. That's why wood always floats. and it's our way of proving by a simple experiment here in the laboratory that Archimedes' principle is correct.
Jiminy, gee, that was a wonderful experiment, Mr. Science. Can I toss this box into the bucket and see if it floats,
no,
too?
No, leave that alone. It contains the ingredients for next week's experiment. Don't touch it,
boy. Well, I only want to toss it in like this and
I'd
see
rather
if... Mr. Science has been brought to you as a public service, paid for by the National Foundation to Improve Things. Today's broadcast was the last in our current series.
We're speaking with David Pollack, and his latest book is a biography of Bob and Ray called Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. Well, now, with Laurel and Hardy, we always know that Stan Laurel was the kind of the creative brain behind the team, and Ollie used to like to play golf. And with Abbott and Costello, you know, Costello was definitely the draw, although Bud Abbott, a superb straight man. What about them? Were they both equally creative? Were they both the writers, or did one write and the other one not?
When they started, when they got into radio, they never wanted to be comedians. Ray always said it was the last thing on his mind. They could imitate people, and they certainly knew what was funny about shows. But as you read in the book, they just wanted to be announcers. Ray would speak from time to time saying he wanted to be a sportscaster. Bob just wanted to be announcers. And they sort of came of age at the same time radio did in the 30s. And, you know, it was the new entertainment. And they were just, they were just enthralled with it. And in those days, announcers were the sort of glamorous, tuxedo-wearing, silky-voiced characters whose voices were well known by everybody.
Bob Elliott, you said in the book, is just enchanted with the idea of having his voice on the radio, that he would muscle his way into a crowd where there was a man on the street interview taking place so that he could be...
That's exactly right. He and his friend used to... Bob was raised in Winchester, Massachusetts, just sort of north of Boston. And he and his friend from high school, from Winchester High, would take the train into Boston and just sort of push their way to the front of these various man-on-the-street programs, which there were several of them. They were a big deal at the time. And just to hear their voices, I mean, it was the act of speaking into a microphone and having your voice go over the radio. And if only one of them went... they would go home at night. He would go home at night and call the other guy and say, you know, did you hear me? How did I sound? So anyway, getting back to your question,
yes.
As far as the creativity, when they started, Ray was hired to read the news on the morning shift at WHDH in Boston, and he would read the news every half hour on Bob Elliott's disc jockey show, a morning show called Sunny Side Up. And they got to kibitzing after the newscast, and it sort of caught on. And it just was sort of infectious, but it was all spontaneous. It just sort of happened, you know. As Bob points out, you know, not all of it was good, but it was something. And then when the station later got the rights to the Boston Red Sox and Boston Braves broadcast, the Braves were still in Boston in those days. This is around 1947. Because they had gotten so popular, they gave them a show ahead of the baseball broadcast called Baseball Matinee with just the two of them. And so they did the only thing they knew, which was imitate radio programs. And it was all spontaneous. There was nothing on paper. They just would start into a bit and imitate popular shows of the day, like they did a show called Dr. OK, which was an imitation of a very popular show then called Dr. IQ, and they imitated soap operas. But a lot of it was very ragged, and it was just as you would imagine, two guys just jumping in and doing it. I mean, they would abort the thing in the middle sometimes. it was, as Bob says in the book, it was very sloppy, but somehow nobody seemed to care. And over time, they sort of, you know, refined various bits that seemed to work well and discarded ones that didn't. But again, getting to your question, there was no, they really didn't talk it through in advance. You know, the only way they knew how to arrive at it was in that sort of spontaneous way. And so that's why I was making the point earlier. They were sort of imitating, they were imitating the shows, but entertaining each other.
There's a certain tone to Bob and Ray routines that, I find them really amusing. But there's not a lot. I mean, not a lot happens. In fact, that's sort of the humor in it, in that nothing is actually happening.
Well, in some bits there's not, in others there is, but I think you're making a good point. They didn't, they weren't necessarily fishing for punchlines. They just assumed these characters, and they knew all the peculiarities of each character, so that they knew all of their quirks, and so. In a bit like their soap opera "Mary Backstage Noble Wife," which was a parody of a long-running CBS soap called "Mary Noble Backstage Wife," they could advance the narrative and see the narrative through the prism of all of their characters. Each one might be doing three different characters in a routine. And so there would be, say, six in the room, and that's six plates to keep spinning. But they wouldn't push for punchlines. They would just keep the dialogue going, and if they stumbled into something, they did, and if they didn't, they didn't worry about it.
I remember a routine of theirs where I guess it was a satire on the Queen for a Day type of show.
Sure.
In which they reunited the Worleys, a brother and sister who had not seen each other for 60 years or something. And the Worleys were completely nonplussed by their reunion.
Yeah.
And then they laughed.
In fact, had nothing to say to each other except, hello. That's one that they did a lot and got a lot of mileage out of that routine. Ultimately, when they got to New York and got on the network, NBC couldn't believe they had a director named Ken McGregor who couldn't believe they were going to ad-lib the show. he said to them, how am I going to direct it? So ultimately, when they were doing television, you know, they were doing a 15-minute TV show every night on NBC at 7:15, and they had the quarter-hour radio show plus an hour on Saturday nights. They did have writers and some very talented ones like Ray Knight and Tom Cook, who were with them for the longest period of times. And those bits you can usually tell. You know, it's not hard to tell, you know, which are the ad-lib ones and which were the written ones.
Tom Cook really seemed to have his finger on the pulse of Bob and Ray.
Excellent writer, and he joined them around 1955, and when they were on the Mutual Network and on Monitor, and many of the bits he wrote that were popular were the Hard Luck Stories, The Gathering Dusk. Bridget Hillary in the News, which was a spoof of a goofy soap opera called Wendy Warren in the News that was on forever on CBS that actually contained a newscast by CBS correspondent Douglas Edwards in the body of the show. And Tom also wrote Squad Car 119, their Dragnet parody, the Do-It-Yourselfer, and Anxiety, which was a spoof of Suspense.
A lot of the things they spoofed, their spoofs lasted longer than the things they were spoofing.
Exactly. You never had to, I point this out too, that you never had to be that familiar with the original. I mean, the parodies just, you know, sort of had were self-contained and had a life of their own. People who, you know, they kept doing this takeoff of the longtime show, Mr. Keen, Tracer of Lost Persons, which they called, you know, Mr. Trace, keener than most persons. And they were these two Irish, you know, detectives who kept saying, Saints preserve us, and these ridiculous, goofy plots that were just funny in and of themselves. You know, by the end, Mr. Keen had been off the air for like 25 years.
We're talking with David Pollack, and he's just written a marvelous book about the comedy team Bob and Ray called Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. Did you meet Bob and Ray? Did you know them? Did you encounter them in your years as a writer?
Never worked with them or for them, but when I was in the Army and stationed in New York, I remember going and watching them at Mutual and on monitor. And then in the 70s, they were on WOR, and I was back there working on a pilot. And Elias and I remember we walked through a blizzard down to WOR to watch them there. And you almost had to close your eyes when you watched them to get the full effect, because, you know, you're just seeing these two guys doing all these voices just sitting there.
And yet, Bob and Ray starred in a Broadway show.
Yeah. Bob and Ray, the two and only, ran on Broadway for about 6 months and then went on the road for a year.
And was it the same every night, or was it a Hell's a Poppin' kind of big
movie? No, it was basically the same every night. Many of the bits that they later did on television shows, like they were on the Tonight Show for
quite often, right?
Well, in fact, they were started when Steve Allen did it, and they were on with Jack Parr and with I think about 18 times they were on with Johnny Carson, and a lot of the bits that they did guesting on TV shows were from the Two and Only. Many of the dramatic pieces, like Mr. Trace or Mary Backstage, didn't work as well on a one-to-one basis with an audience present. Those were more things you had to visualize in your imagination. So the bits they did on the Broadway show were more interview-oriented and shorter and quicker. But it was, had a set, and it was a, you know, well-produced show.
Now, Bob Elliott is still with us. Does he know about your book?
He cooperated fully through the entire book.
Is he happy with the book?
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
well,
he is. He was very cooperative and very candid, and just as candid with their disappointments as their successes.
We're delighted to have with us the world-renowned Komodo Dragon Authority from Upper Montclair, New Jersey, Dr. Daryl Dexter. Dr. Dexter, would you tell everybody all about the Komodo Dragon, please?
The Komodo Dragon is the world's largest living lizard. It's found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago, and nearby Rinja, Padar, and Flores. It's a ferocious carnivory, and one swipe of its tail can render an enemy senseless.
Now, where do they come from?
The Komodo dragon, the world's largest living lizard, is found on the steep-sloped island of Komodo, hence its name. and that is in the Lesser Sunda chain of the Indonesian archipelago and the nearby islands of Rinja, Padar, and Flores. We have two in this country, two Komodo dragons, which were given to us some years ago by the late former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno.
I believe I read somewhere where a foreign potentate gave America some Komodo dragons. Is that true?
Yes. The former premier of Indonesia, Sukarno, gifted this country with two Komodo dragons, world's largest living lizards, some years ago. And they're in the National Zoo in Washington.
Well, now, if we wanted to take the children to see a Komodo dragon, where would we take the children to see a Komodo dragon?
If you were in the vicinity of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., you would take the kiddos to the National Zoo. And there you would see two Komodo dragons, the world's largest living lizards. There's a stuffed Komodo dragon in the lobby of the Royal Hotel in Kathmandu, Nepal.
I believe they're of the lizard family, aren't they?
Yes, they're the world's largest living lizard. And they're ferocious carnivory. One swipe of their tail can render an enemy senseless.
I believe we've just about exhausted the subject. I want to thank you very much for coming by. I know it works a great hardship on you to come in here from Upper Montclair, New Jersey.
Yes.
And I want to thank you. Do you have a ride home?
No, I don't.
Well, maybe somebody here in the audience would be kind enough to give you a lift after the show.
That would be very nice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I think everybody will enjoy it. And if you're not a Bob and Ray fan, you will be after you read the book. The book's a lot of laughs, I mean, because it's about two comedians and it tells a lot of their routines, and I laughed every night reading it. And the author is my guest, comedy writer David Pollack. David Pollack, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's been a pleasure, Gary. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, David Pollack. His new book, Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.